Welcome back to Scarlet Tavern. So tonight's episode is going to be a little different. We do want to apologize. We have not posted in a while. We have had a lot of things going on in the background that we have been dealing with, whether it's issues with technology or dealing with getting doing the relaunch of the business, things like that. We've had a lot on our plates, so we haven't been posting like we normally do. So like I said, tonight's a little bit different because it's not just another show. We have decided that it's going to be our season finale. We've had an incredible time bringing you stories, laughs, and conversations this year, but again, as I said, we've got a lot on our plate right now. Between preparing for the big relaunch of the business and getting Dungeons and Magi ready for its live return, it's time for us to pause the tavern for a bit. It's not goodbye, it's just a break. We're coming back next season with even more to share, and we can't wait to bring all of you along for what's ahead. We truly want to thank you for being a part of this journey with us, for supporting Scarlet Tavern, and for giving us a reason to keep creating. So, after tonight, after this episode, that will be it for the year. This episode, we're recording it tonight. It will come out on Tuesday. When it comes out on Tuesday, it will be the final episode of the season. We're going to kind of revamp, relaunch. We're bringing a lot of new stuff. We are still going to do some revamps to kind of take place of some of the old stuff, bringing you a lot of new content, as well as we are bringing back the nerdy content that we had for a little bit in season one. But this time at a bigger, grander scale. So mostly focusing on like D&D, of course, because I mean, that's our bread and butter. That's how all of this started, was D&D. And
to give me a little break of having to write and research.
So, this is going to allow us to kind of just revamp everything, focus on, again, Dungeons and Magi, because that's a massive, massive return. That is what's taking up a lot of our time and focus. Because unlike this is honestly, Scarlet Tavern's really easy because we just sit down, we talk, we pre-record this, okay. It gets put out.
I should say it's pretty easy for you and Ben, as the researcher and writer for the episodes,
compared to takes me my a little world bit. Building, it's...
Okay, I should say Ben has the easy part.
Children behave.
Kate and I do the bread and butter of it.
So I'm the face. I'm the one who has the face for
this.
Is
that why we're not getting any listeners?
Wow, we have plenty of listeners.
Where? I don't know. Ones that don't speak English.
Yeah, they're listening.
This is much easier than Dungeons and Magi is. Because number one, it's just the three of us here. We don't have to rely on other people and other people's schedules, things like that.
Or make sure that any platform that we're using isn't fucking up at times.
Correct. So, and just to be completely transparent, we had microphone issues on our last recording session of Dungeons and Magi, and we ended up having to go buy brand new microphones.
Luckily, we found those before, and we didn't have to have much of a delay on that, because then everything would have kind of grounded to a halt.
So, if our audio sounds 10 times better, that's why, because we're using brand new shotgun mics, and they're amazing microphones.
And I don't have to yell anymore.
Things are going to be nice and crispy. But, with all that being said, we're going to finish up, because we didn't want to leave everything in the middle. That wouldn't be fair to just kind of leave it on Ed Gein on a cliffhanger. Well, it'd be fair to leave him on a cliffhanger.
Yeah. But I did a lot of work on this one.
We're going to finish up Ed Gein, and then we're going to call it a wrap for the rest of the season and then come back in January.
And if you guys have topic ideas, reach out to us. Like, you can comment or
send us an email. Send Ben an email to his personal email.
No.
Our email again is scarlet.tavern.podcast@gmail.com. You can find that email address on YouTube, on our Facebook account. So just send us a message.
Yeah.
And you can, or you can just send us, do a contact us through the website.
Correct.
That'll go through even, it's Dan Media, and most of it's focused on Dungeons and Magi. It's still all one entity. So it will be doing that. And we're going to have some exciting things next season. I'm going to try next season for some of these nerdy things, especially to see if we can get some guests on and do some little guest spots and things like that, whether it's our friends or it's people that are in the D&D community. I'm hoping, my plan is at the beginning of the year to reach out to some of the bigger names and see if I can get them on to interview them and talk to them and things like that. So, and then we'll probably bring it. My goal is to try and bring in some experts in some of these places too, like criminology experts. I know I've talked to, personally, I have talked to, my mom, who is an oncology nurse, and getting her on for an episode or two to talk about medical side of things. I have enough medical knowledge, but nowhere near what she has. And then that's the other thing too, is we are going to go to not just be a podcast. This is going to be a video cast.
Ooh.
So cameras, you're going to see everything. You're going to, Ben's going to have to actually be dressed during this.
Not just pajamas. Yeah. I mean, we're all kind of guilty of it. I can't say Ben's just guilty.
I was about to say, why am I being singled out on this?
Because you're the one sitting here with a blanket wrapped around you like you're 80 years old.
Oh. But we don't... Do we make fun of Pam whenever she has to wrap up in a blanket because she's cold?
Am I wrapped up in a blanket right now?
I mean, yes. I realize that your lack of hair allows cold in, but
there's a reason why I'm wearing a sweatshirt and long pants right now.
But, yes, we're going to go to videocast, so you'll be able to see, obviously it'll still come out on Spotify and everything, but you'll be able to see the actual video of everything on YouTube. And then if we come up with some other interesting things, we may use our version of Patreon. We use Buy Me a Coffee. But we may have some episodes that are on Buy Me a Coffee where you get access to episodes earlier. You get exclusive episodes, exclusive interviews, things like that. Like, if I can land some of these big names that I'm hoping, some of those may be on Buy Me a Coffee. And you can hear the interviews there. And then we're planning on having more listener engagement. So you commenting, you subscribing, things like that. The more of those we get, the more we're going to shout you out. We've got a few things that I'm thinking of that are in the works that we'll kind of discuss as things go on. But definitely check out our social media for that. And we're going to be better about posting on our socials. We've been really shitty on all of our socials.
So but what you're saying is, Pam, can you come up with a schedule for posting?
Yeah. But yeah, with that being said, do believe it is time. Oh, wrong show.
Wrong show.
Like, damn it, I haven't gotten all my stuff.
I do believe it is time for Ed Gein. But in all seriousness, thank you. Thank you for listening to us and giving us the ability to do this. So,
and just to let you know, we didn't come to this conclusion easily. It was at least a week or two of just going back and forth of us ending the podcast early to give you guys better quality content and stuff for next season.
We're definitely of the mindset of quality over quantity. So if we don't, we'd rather give you one good, solid show as opposed to just throw out a bunch of mediocre episodes that we just we're only half putting effort into it.
Yeah. So, and again, it's been like 2 months since we've
It's only been like a month,
And a half since we recorded anything. So we believe we ended on what we have listed as our part six. So we are
part
going
six or part seven.
We ended on part six.
Okay.
Meaning we're going into part seven. So if there is a little gap in there, we do apologize. But we believe this is where we left off. So this episode's not going to be that long. This is going to be a quick little episode. So we'll probably sit here and bullshit a little bit afterwards and discuss things a little more. Give you guys a little more content for the last episode. Because normally our finale episodes are pretty long. But we don't want to get into anything else and then kind of just leave it there for months until the beginning of next year. So with that being said, Pam.
All right. By the spring of 1958, the Gein farmhouse had become more than just a crime scene. It had become a symbol of terror. Reporters called it the House of Horrors. Locals whispered about what still might be hidden under its floors. People drove past it to catch a glimpse of the decaying structure that once held a nightmare within its walls. There was talk of turning it into a museum. Some outsiders, never having stepped foot in Plainfield before, saw dollar signs. They wanted to capitalize on the gruesome fascination the world now held with Ed Gein's crimes. But to the people who had lived beside him, who had shopped at Bernice Worden's store, who had known Mary Hogan, who had buried their own loved ones in the cemeteries he had defiled, that idea was a cruel, tasteless insult. The town didn't want infamy. It tried to heal.
So, again, you weren't alive in 1958.
No.
Ben was, but you weren't.
I wasn't.
But being somebody who is from here... Or here adjacent.
Yeah.
We're going to say here adjacent. We don't want to tell exactly where everybody's from. But here adjacent, you can kind of give that insight. And you know, like, even to this day, that...
There's still
people that drive through here to see everything, even though there's nothing there.
So...
Because his grave isn't marked anymore.
His grave isn't marked, and I...
Because people kept stealing the fucking tombstone.
They didn't necessarily start with stealing the tombstone, and we'll get more into it later. They more chipped away at pieces of it. Then it got stolen. Then it was recovered, and his grave just stays unmarked. But if you're from the area, you know where it is because you know the family name, you know all of that. But the museum would have never fucking flew, like, at all. It would have been... And you'll see, we're going to get into it now. But before the town could decide what to do with the property, fate, or something more intentional, intervened.
It was intentional.
It was intentional. Somebody set fire to this fucking place.
It was intentional, but it was not ruled an arson.
Of course it wasn't ruled an arson, because they weren't going to arrest the people. This is a small town. They're not going to arrest the people that did it.
Oh, no, there's a... So there's theories about who did it.
Yeah, Frank Worden.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a fucking firefighter.
No, he was a police officer. He's part of the sheriff's department.
He was one of the firefighters on the scene, Frank Worden.
Frank Worden was a
I'm literally reading what you said.
Okay, I misspoke. Frank Worden was a police officer, not a firefighter. Hold on. Now I'm confused. I'm confusing myself.
He may have been an arson investigator.
For the record, honey, when I was looking through this to edit, I didn't catch that because I didn't know it was wrong. So I cannot be blamed for this. But yeah, as you all can figure out, the house burnt down. And
not Stop. Okay. We haven't gotten to that part yet.
He was the deputy sheriff.
Yes. So he wasn't the fire marshal. So, whoopsie.
But.
My mistake.
No. I mean, cops still know how to do this stuff,
too. Yeah. On the morning of March 20th, 1958, just 10 days before Ed Gein's possessions were scheduled to be auctioned, smoke began to rise from the edges of the farmhouse. By the time the fire department arrived, it was too late. The house was gone, burned to the ground, reduced to smoldering rubble. Only a few outbuildings remained. Because I've driven past this area, nothing remains. Officially, the fire's case was never determined. A cleaning crew had reportedly been burning trash near the property, and hot coals were discovered at the site. But the fire didn't appear to spread naturally. The blaze jumped directly into the house, almost deliberately. Suspicion of arson was immediate, and in Plainfield, no one seemed particularly eager to find the culprit. After all, the idea of tourists walking through the rooms where neighbors had been butchered and skinned was unbearable. For townspeople, the fire wasn't a tragedy, it was a cleansing. One of the police officers on the scene was Frank Warden, the son of Gein's final victim. He said little as the home went up in flames. Others speculated that if arson was involved, the act may have come not from revenge, but from a desire to bury what was left, to make sure no one could ever turn Ed Gein's legacy into entertainment.
If you look in Slack, I posted how it is now.
Yeah,
there's a gate up there, and it's just field now.
Field and forest, that's it.
Unmarked, nothing, there's not even, a property marker, because typically when you have a field like that, and being from country, that there's typically like markers on the gates to tell you the lot number.
Yeah.
But they don't even do that because they don't want people just going. Because honestly, you would drive right by that.
Oh yeah. I would think that's just somebody's property.
Mainly the locals know where it is.
Yeah. And they're not gonna tell outsiders.
When I say locals, I mean the locals of like Washoe County, Wisconsin, all of that. Not like, you wouldn't know where it was unless I showed you where it was.
Yeah, and
I don't even remember the exact positioning of the house.
And if I remember you correctly, you said the house itself had, like, no electricity or anything, right?
Not that I remember. No, it didn't.
This house was pretty much cut off from the grid.
Yeah, yes. So it was way far back.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they were like, that must be... That's something.
Honestly, they didn't give a shit.
I don't blame them. I mean... And honestly, I don't know how... Even as a tourist attraction... Because from what I understood from earlier in the episode... The house was decrepit and falling down around it. Only, like, parts of the house were actually kind of livable.
Well, it was decrepit and
dilapidated.
That word. But they could have fixed it up. Made it into a tourist attraction.
Yeah.
Which they would have never allowed.
Yeah. Nah, it's just as well this, like, I think, just as well the thing burnt down.
So you can see that square is not the house, that is the lot. So the house was back towards the trees.
Yes.
So, it looks like that's a house, but it's just the shape of the lot.
Mm.
And so the driveway was there, and then you had to go all the way back to the
house. Because there's an image of this thing being, like, deeper in the woods.
Mm-mm.
No.
They've kind of just let it overgrow, because if I remember right, it used to be farmland.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see here that there is just road, like... That's, like, an original photo of the house.
Yeah.
So you can see how close the road actually is.
So they've kind of just let it go to waste. Yeah. The only thing that only reason that I knew that Ed Gein was held in the Washoe County jail, it's now the historical museum of Washoe County, is because I volunteered there for an assignment or something. I can't remember what it was for. And the tour guide told me, hey, this is Ed Gein's cell. The cell that he was in before he was tried for everything. They really keep it all hush hush. Like,
I'm sure nobody wants to. Even today, they probably still don't want to attract all those weirdo murder obsessed fans who want to go and pay homage or something like that. Which has happened and still does happen to a number of locales throughout the country where infamous murders happen. Those people are weird.
Yeah, they are. When Gein was told his childhood home had burned down, his response was characteristically unemotional. Just as well, he said, nothing more. That quiet acceptance followed him for the rest of his life. Confined to the Mendota Mental Health Institute, Ed Gein grew old behind closed doors. He spent his days reading, watching television, and participating in hospital routines. He kept himself. Staff described him as calm, compliant, and in some cases, disturbingly pleasant. Yeah, that's what I've pictured. Like,
for
just
those, for those who don't know, who can't see, Kay just did the most creepiest hey smile.
But I don't think he would have smiled. Like, all intent. Like,
no, the most he's ever done is
like a smirk.
Yeah. I think
it was, he never fully blown smiled.
I think somebody, what was it? The movie Psycho, which was partially based on Ed Gein. There's a Gregory Peck? He did that little creepy.
We need to watch the new Ed Gein.
Mm-hmm.
He did like a really creepy smile. I think that's what Gein would do sometimes. I think he modeled that smile after that. For those of you who don't know, watch the original Psycho black and white version. You'll like it.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm good.
But there is the new Ed Gein. There's this the new Monsters series that they're doing. And they just did Ed Gein with... what's his name? He played Jackson, Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
I never watched that show.
He's playing Ed Gein. And they're getting ready to release... who's next?
Is it called Monsters?
It's Monsters or something like that. Monster, the Ed Gein story. Charlie Hunnam, that's who it is.
Oh, him.
Laurie Metcalf plays his mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, Laurie Metcalf's an amazing actress.
So, it looks like the first season might have been Jeffrey Dahmer, and then
third is Ed Gein.
Yeah, the second is the Mendez brothers.
Menendez.
Yeah.
And then the fourth, they already announced the fourth, it's Lizzie Borden.
Ooh.
The fourth. And it's Ella Beatty playing Lizzie Borden, which will be pretty good.
And don't worry, guys. We're covering Lizzie Borden next season.
Yep.
Yeah, Lizzie Borden's one of my favorites. We'll do the whole nursery rhyme and everything, too.
Oh, I already have that multiple times throughout the script.
So.
He never acted out. He rarely discussed the past. It was as if the man who once turned bodies into furniture had stopped. But something about that stillness unnerved the people around him. Nurses noted his long, unsettling stares, particularly toward women. Visitors described a strange sense of abstinence in his presence, as if he were only partly there. As the years passed, Ed faded further into the institution, not just physically, but spiritually. The man who once roamed the Plainfield woods with a shovel now roamed sterile corridors and slippers. His final years were quiet, unremarkable. He began to suffer from respiratory problems, compounded by lung cancer.
you know, here's the thing. So we don't know if he was ever a smoker. They don't ever talk about it. I feel like he got lung cancer from the fire he killed his brother in.
Yeah. I mean, it
from inhaling all that smoke.
Could have been.
Yeah.
That's just my belief that it's just karma. That honestly, he kills his brother in that fire, and that fire ends up killing him years later. Because we don't know if he smoked. They don't ever talk about it. We don't see images of him smoking.
I don't think it was ever specified that he was smoked, and I don't think it was ever brought up in anything that I was ever told about him.
Who knows?
On July 26th, 1984. Wow.
1948. He died back in time.
Yeah.
Before he was even born.
1984. Ed Gein died at the age of 77. He passed away in the same calm, indifferent manner he had lived for decades after his crimes, without incident, without fanfare. But that didn't put an end to the public's fascination. Gein's body was returned to Plainfield, the very town he had haunted for so long. He was buried in the family plot at Plainfield Cemetery, just a short walk from some of the graves he had once robbed. His final resting place was nestled between his parents and his brother Henry, whose death, to this day, still raises uneasy questions, because it's never been verified that he killed Henry.
Correct.
Though officially ruled as an accident, caused by smoke inhalation during a brush fire in 1944, Henry Gein's death has long been surrounded by unease. Ed reported his brother missing, yet led searchers directly to the body in a spot they had already scouted. And while no autopsy was performed, some who saw Henry's remains noted bruises on his head, injuries that didn't align with the fire narrative. No charges were filed, and the incident faded into rural memory. But in hindsight, many view that moment not just as a tragedy, but as a potential prologue to a quiet, deadly fracture in a family already teetering on the edge. Now, both brothers lie in the same soil, one remembered with suspicion, the other with horror. For years, curious visitors made pilgrimages to his grave. Some chipped pieces from the headstone, taken as morbid souvenirs. Others took photos. The marker became a dark landmark, a destination for those fascinated by the macabre. But in 2000, the entire gravestone was stolen. It wasn't recovered until the following year, when it was found in Seattle, Washington. That's a long ways away.
Ben stole it.
Because I've been to Seattle.
See, you just admitted to
it. No, I really haven't.
The authorities quietly brought it back and placed it in secure storage. Gein's grave remains unmarked to this day, but not unknown. Locals still know where to find it, a patch of grass among the worn stones, surrounded by silence and the weight of memory. No monument, no epitaph, just earth. And perhaps that's fitting, because in the end, the man who unearthed so many others, who violated graves and tried to remake the dead in his image, now lies beneath the same soil, with nothing but time to cover what he left behind. Though Ed Gein died in 1984, his story refused to stay buried. Long after his body was laid to rest in an unmarked grave, his crimes were reborn again and again, not in courtrooms or case files, but on the screen, in novels, and in the twisted imaginations of storytellers looking to capture something truly monstrous. Because Gein wasn't just a man. He became a blueprint, a cultural archetype of madness that still lingers in our nightmares. Long after Ed Gein's trial faded from the headlines and his ashes settled beneath the unmarked soil of Plainfield Cemetery, his shadow began to stretch, not over courtrooms or towns, but across the flickering screens of horror cinema. His story didn't disappear. It evolved. It multiplied. And it took on a life of its own. Because, unlike most killers who inspire fear through scale or spectacle, Gene became something far more insidious. A symbol. A blueprint. Not just for a person, for what a person could do, but for what they could believe. It began with Robert Bloch's 1959 novel, Psycho. A fictional account loosely based on Gene's crimes, but focused on something far more terrifying than gore, psychology. Bloch lived just 35 miles from Plainfield when the news broke, and that proximity left its mark. The story of Norman Bates, a shy motel keeper with a controlling mother and a violent alter ego, was less an adaptation of Gene's life than a spiritual echo, a literary translation of his fractured identity. When Alfred Hitchcock brought Psycho to the screen in 1960, it changed horror forever.
Great movie.
Greatest movies ever created.
Okay. Can you stop?
What?
Okay.
The curtain, shower curtain opening.
I am terrified of horror.
Oh, Psycho isn't normal horror, though.
It's more
suspense.
Psychological thriller.
I'm not a fan of psychological
Alfred
thrillers.
Alfred Hitchcock was one of the greatest to live. You know, he's in the Ed Gein one. Somebody's playing him, Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh.
In Monsters.
I was about to say, Hitchcock liked to insert himself in his own movies, like little cameos, but,
Yeah, Tom Hollander is playing Alfred Hitchcock in it, so.
Tom Hollander or Tom Holland?
Tom Hollander.
Okay.
Tom Holland is not old enough or look anything like Alfred Hitchcock.
About to say.
Tom Hollander does.
Okay, it's very similar, that's why I had to ask.
Tom Hollander has been in a lot of stuff like Pirates of the Caribbean and Pride and Prejudice and all of that.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That's how, Alfred Hitchcock was introduced in his show, the Alfred Hitchcock Show.
Norman Bates didn't wear a hockey mask or stalk sorority girls. He was soft-spoken, polite, gentle, till he wasn't, just like Ed.
I will say, if there's people that don't like Psycho, they don't like watching the old movies, go watch Bates Motel.
Yeah.
It was actually a really good adaptation of Psycho. It was showing the whole Bates story from Norman Bates' standpoint. And it was done amazingly well. And that kid now is a huge actor.
Yeah,
he's the one that plays in The Good Doctor.
Okay, yeah.
He was Norman Bates in Bates Motel. That's what made him famous.
Yep.
From there, the Gene influence spread like a dark pulse through the horror genre. In 1974... Director Tobe Hooper introduced audiences to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a film that claimed to be based on true events. It wasn't strictly speaking, but Leatherface, the chainsaw-wielding cannibal who wears human skin as a mask, was unmistakably Gein in spirit. Mm-hmm. Hooper later admitted that his inspiration came from reading about Gein's crimes as a child. The idea of flesh as disguise, of turning the dead into trophies, had lingered with him for years.
And I talk about Leatherface all the time when I'm talking about Ed Gein because, again, the actual everything that happens, like, we know Ed Gein didn't chase people around with chainsaws and all of that, but really, the only thing that took that was wearing the skin on the face.
Yeah, because Ed Gein was trying to make that.
Yeah. All right, so. Yeah,
Buffalo Bill.
Yep. Then came Buffalo Bill, the villain of The Silence of the Lambs, 1991. A killer who abducts women to make a skin suit so he can transform. The parallels go the parallels to Gein's attempts to become his mother through the harvesting of skin were obvious. However, in Buffalo Bill, the horror was updated, more calculated, and more stylized, yet no less rooted in Gein's legacy of becoming the dead rather than merely destroying them.
It puts the lotion on and does what it's told.
Mm-hmm. Even horror films that didn't directly cite Gein carried his fingerprints, in tone, in setting, and the pervasive fear that monsters don't always look like monsters. Sometimes, they look like your neighbor, a handyman, a babysitter, a man who waves from his porch and walks into town with his head down. Beyond film, Gein's influence crept into music, literature, and art. Metal bands wrote songs named after him. Underground zines obsessed over crime scene photos and sketches of his farmhouse. His name appeared in stand-up routines, comic books, and even fashion collections, usually a shorthand for depravity, for something so dark it's Gein level.
So, some famous bands did Ed Gein music. So Slayer, they did a song called Dead Skin Mask in 1990. Mudvayne did one called Nothing to Gein. Macabre did Ed Gein. Killdozer, Electric Hellfire Club. There was a band called Dahmer. Their whole album was themed around serial killers. The Misfits have done stuff. So there was quite a bit of music.
Yeah.
Bunch of weirdos.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's just...
However, the most unsettling aspect of Gein's cultural legacy is that he never needed to be a prolific killer to earn it. He wasn't a Ted Bundy or a John Wayne Gacy. His confirmed victim counts never climbed above 2, yet his impact surpassed them all. Why? Because what Ed Gein represented wasn't just murder, it was distortion. His crimes felt less like explosions of rage and more like rituals of grief. There was no sadistic glee, no taunting letters, just quiet compulsion. And that made him more chilling than any thrill killer. He wasn't hunting. He was repairing, rebuilding, trying to make something broken whole again. That psychological weight, the warped innocence of his motives, created a villain archetype that didn't fit into standard boxes. Gein was not just the foundation for horror icons. He was the beginning of a new conversation in the media, one about the intersection of trauma, delusion, and violence. Filmmakers weren't just mimicking his crimes. They were asking why they happened. What happens when grief goes unchecked? Is a child ever allowed to grow into their own identity? When love curdles into fixation? Even now, the fascination with Ed Gein continues. Documentaries were released. Podcasts dissect his case. Netflix dramatizes his story for a new generation. Some productions focus on the facts. Others bend them to their advantage. But no matter the approach, they all tap into the same primal fear. That evil isn't always charismatic or loud. Sometimes it's quiet, shy, unassuming, and living right down the road. In that sense, Ed Gein didn't just influence pop culture, he changed it. He became the template for horror that unsettles rather than startles. That makes your skin crawl not with screams, but with silence. With the idea that the man next door, the one who babysits your kids and fixes your fences, might be slowly building a shrine out of grief, bone, and memory. And that somehow might be worse than the monsters we see coming. It's easy to lose sight of the real man behind the mask once Hollywood gets involved. To see Ed Gein as a character rather than a consequence. But behind every film, every headline, and every grotesque artifact was a boy raised in silence. A man warped by grief and a legacy built not on body count, but on the terrifying idea that what we bury doesn't always stay buried.
And before we conclude this, I want to bring up what I always bring up with... So, technically, Ed Gein's not a serial killer.
No.
No.
So, for those that don't know, the standard definition of a serial killer is someone with a pattern. Somebody that has the same MO, and you have to kill three consecutively in a short period of time. So, if I kill somebody now, kill somebody in 10 years, and then kill somebody 2 years after that, it's technically not a serial killer because there's no pattern to it. Now, if I do it every 10 years, then yes, there's a pattern there. He technically, as far as we know, only killed two people. So it doesn't make him a serial killer.
Even if we were to include his brother in on that, it's still different.
It's because crimes of passion to me.
I mean, by all accounts, as we've already covered, Ed and his brother Henry had a very, very troubled relationship. Yeah. I personally think he killed him. Oh, I mean,
everybody knows.
He hit him in the head.
Yeah, he just...
And then he suffocated in the
smoke. In the smoke. I mean, but Ed killed him because, okay, you SOB, I'm tired of your shit you've given me and mother.
Punk! Well, it wasn't necessarily the shit that he was giving him.
By all like accounts, him and his mother. He was bullying his... Henry was bullying Ed remorselessly.
He was, because Henry didn't see their mother as end-all, be-all.
Yeah, and
where Ed saw his mother as end-all, be-all.
So, and I'm sure that was a very big contributing factor, but again, though, I feel like the thing that really pushed him to pick that shovel up and hit Henry in the back of the head
was... We don't know if it was a shovel. We don't know what it was.
Whatever. Whatever
he still hit him.
He hit him in the head. It doesn't matter what he used, but what made Ed push him to kill his brother was probably, from what we've seen and talked to, I think they had an argument earlier that day, and of course Henry was just laying into Ed, and he probably just had enough, and he's like, you know what, plink, and Ed just left him there, and he bled out or he suffocated.
If I remember right, it was an argument about Henry wanting to leave the farm to go be with a divorced woman who already had kids.
Yeah.
And he was trying to get Ed to join him. He was trying to get Ed away from his mother. But Ed didn't see it that way. He saw his mother as God.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Henry kept at it, Ed snapped.
Yeah, and just took out his brother. But again, like Kate said, even if we did include that as in there, he's still not a serial killer. No. He's just so bizarre of a killer. It's why he's so noteworthy.
But one of the big things that I talk about when we talk about serial killers or people like this, nurture versus nature.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big question. Would Ed Gein have done any of this if his mother was not the way that she was?
I don't think so. He still may have been just an odd boy, but
I think he would have been odd. I don't think he would have killed anybody.
No.
So if we notice, he did nothing wrong until his mother was dead.
Exactly.
Yes, he had a weird childhood, uber religious, all of that stuff. It's weird. I mean, he might as well have been Mormon. But, to all our Mormon listeners there. If you're listening to us and you're Mormon, then
you need to
go talk to Joseph Smith. But, because you should not be listening to our stuff, I'm sure that...
Sure violates some tenets.
Yeah. Nothing happened until his mother died and he needed to fill that hole.
Mm-hmm.
And so I firmly believe if she would not have treated him like that, if it would have just been a normal thing, or she would not have died abruptly. That was the thing, is it wasn't like, oh, we know she's going to die.
Yeah, it was.
She was gone. She got sick, she was gone, boom, done, and it ended. If she would have lived to old age, honestly, it probably wouldn't have happened if she lived to old age, because he would have been able to prepare himself. Okay,
we have 10 years left with her. We have 5 years left with her.
I don't think so with that, just because of how much Ed was devoted to his mother. I think after she passed, no matter if it was expected, unexpected, he would have ended up doing the same.
Probably. I tend to agree with Pam on that one. I think, unfortunately, the damage that she did to him was irreversible. I mean, the only way, honestly, the only way Ed is somehow fairly normal is if she dies first and Ed and his brother are more or less raised by their father.
Well, now, no. His father was an abusive asshole.
Not that we know of. We don't know that.
His father was
a drunk.
Drunk, but we don't know
that he was abusive. We have no evidence of that.
But here's the thing, though. Does Ed turn into an alcoholic or a psycho who digs up people and wears their skin like a suit? As opposed to, which he became, his mother.
His father was the lesser of two evils.
Yeah. As now, probably, again.
Probably would have just been a drunk and died of alcohol poisoning and made the world a better place.
Probably, like.
But just, I also think he had, it never specifies if he had a mental illness, but
they didn't really test for it back then.
Yeah, and so also I think he did have, unfortunately, a mental illness that
could have.
Was exacerbated by his mother.
Yeah, I mean, probably as we've...
By the lack of support from his father, being an alcoholic, his brother bullying him because he was a mama's boy, and his mother being an abusive religious zealot, that it all just kind of compounded to what we have today.
So, yeah.
To conclude...
Ed Gein's story doesn't end with his death, or even with the ashes of his infamous farmhouse smoldering in the Wisconsin dirt. His legacy was never just about what he did. It's about what he represented. A man shaped not by bloodlust, but by isolation, obsession, and emotional decay. A legacy not built on a long list of victims, but on the terrifying intimacy of his crimes. In the annals of American crime, some killers shock and some killers linger. Gein is the latter. His case remains one of the most dissected, analyzed, and mythologized in criminal history. Not because of its scale, but because of its symbolism. He's the embodiment of a particular horror. The idea that madness can exist in silence, that monstrosity doesn't always come with a snarl or a knife, but can develop slowly in the shadows of grief and control. Even now, decades later, Ed Gein continues to haunt us, not as a figure of fear alone, but as a mirror. His story forces uncomfortable questions. What happens when pain is never processed? When does control become obsession? When a child is raised to believe the world is evil and the love, and that love means ownership. His crimes were gruesome, but they weren't driven by sadism. They weren't driven by a desperate attempt to hold onto someone who was already gone. Or they were driven by a desperate attempt to hold onto someone who's already gone. To stitch together memory and identity using the only materials he could access, flesh and bone. He wasn't just a murderer. He was a man trying to reverse death, to undo loss, to recreate love in a form he could touch, wear, inhabit. It's what makes his legacy so hard to categorize. He wasn't a serial killer in the traditional sense. He wasn't a cult leader or a spree killer. He was something in between, a tragic figure who became terrifying, not by his intent, but by his detachment from reality. He turned grief into ritual and a longing for violence. And so, his farmhouse may be gone, his grave may be unmarked, but Ed Gein lives on, in the quiet horror that sits beneath so many of our cultural myths. His name is whispered in true crime forums, in horror conventions, studied in psychology classrooms, and dramatized on television screens. And though time continues to pass and his case grows older, one truth remains unshakable. The scariest thing about Ed Gein isn't the trophies he made or the graves he disturbed. It's the possibility that something like him could happen again, not in a slasher film or a pulp novel, but in real life. Somewhere quiet, somewhere rural, somewhere forgotten. A man alone, in his grief, building something in the dark, piece by piece.
Yeah, so glad you're doing this because I have a hard time saying rural.
Rural?
Because of my accent.
Rural?
Rural. It comes out weird. But yeah, so Ed Gein. Like we said, and we're before we give our final outro of the season, we want to thank everybody once again. If we didn't have listeners, we couldn't do this. There would be no point. And we may not be the biggest true crime podcast. We're not, God, now I can't think of words. No, I can't think of the podcast I was going to say. Like Necronomipod, they're honestly the reason I wanted to start a true crime podcast. They're great. They're hilarious and they're not far from here. So Necronomipod, if any of you hear this, I would love to collaborate with you guys. We only live like an hour and a half away. So again, we may not be the biggest podcast, but we do have quite a few of you that listen to us. And coming into this next season, we really would like a lot more engagement. We want to hear from you guys. We're doing topics that we like, but we also want to do some topics that you like. Maybe there's stuff that you know that's maybe local to you that nobody's touched on. Maybe none of these big ones have touched on somebody that did something bad that passed through your hometown or something like that, and we would love to touch on that. We would love to dig in and see if we can research and even stuff that's even family histories. If you guys want to send us stories, that as long as we have your permission and we will share these family stories, because there's plenty of families out there that are so old that they have histories like this. Like, luckily, there are no more Geins in the world.
No.
Yeah. That we know of.
No, there isn't.
The actual Geins, neither of the boys have kids. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
No, the Gein bloodline's dead.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure the father didn't have any siblings.
No. The Geins are dead.
That's good.
But, yeah, so, like, there's stories like that. I mean, I've heard horror stories from my family, like way back when of some bad things that some of my family members have gotten into that we didn't even know, that I won't talk about on here. But yeah, so just send us those. We would love to hear those. And once again, thank you for allowing us to do this. We cannot wait for the next season.
Should we give them a spoiler of what's coming for our first session? Our first video cast?
Yeah, so we are opening with probably the biggest thing we've ever done.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's kind of why we, another reason that we're kind of taking a break for a little bit.
Because I need to do a shit ton of fucking research, and it's going to drive me fucking nuts, because I have to cut down all of that research to fit into an hour and a half.
Yeah, so,
so wish me luck.
Yeah, we are literally going to kick it off. January 17th is going to be when the vodcast comes out. That'll be the first one of the year, giving us time to record everything. But we are starting off with the Holocaust. So we have a three-parter on the Holocaust. We have quite a bit of there. And then we're doing some really cool stuff. I mean, without giving away everything we're doing some repeats. We've got, like I said, a couple D&D things that we're going to be doing towards the beginning of the year. And then we're also, I mean, and one of them is, one of the nerdy things goes into mental health. Yes. So, kind of dealing with that. But we have quite a bit that we're doing. Some repeats, a lot of new stuff.
We didn't want to leave you guys hanging with, like, us saying that this whole season was primarily going to be repeats.
Because it was.
Yeah. It was. So next season, we're going to give you guys the repeats, but also throw in a lot of new stuff. We sat for a couple hours going over what we wanted to do for next season to make sure that we could give you guys a great podcast.
Yeah, and we're also theming it, some of them, to the months. Like, for Black History Month in February, we're doing two things. We're doing the Hanafi Siege of Washington, D.C.
Which we've also covered. Correct. But it is what I feel like is one of our better episodes.
Redoing it, showing the, unfortunately, the darker side of African American history.
Yep.
And then the good side of African American history, the Montford Marines.
Yep.
The first all-black Marine unit. And so we're going to do that and honor those guys, because they're a pretty cool unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it also flows in with our World War II.
Yeah.
You will probably see next season a lot of our histories coming up.
Yes, I believe we have a lot of history stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Holocaust, Hanafi,
the Marine one.
Montford Marines, Project Paperclip, History of Samhain, all of that kind of stuff.
That one I'm excited for.
And we are finally going to be getting into two of my favorite serial killers.
I hate the one, I hate...
John Wayne Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer.
Okay, I hate John Wayne Gacy.
My...
Not just because he's a fucking serial killer. Because he has to be a fucking clown.
I mean, that was his day job.
So,
and that one, actually, I'd like to get a statement from your mother. She doesn't have to be on here, but I'd like... She was alive during the John Wayne Gacy...
My mother has the worst memory in the world. She probably
but your other family would know too.
How about we ask my mother, because she was in the air. She wasn't in Illinois. I'm from Wisconsin. My mom was born in Illinois, moved to Wisconsin as a child. I could try and get quotes from some of my family members that were
around
that area.
Yeah.
That time.
If I were to get anything about from my mother about anything, it would be about Son of Sam. Yeah, and that was only because that scared the hell out of everyone in New York.
We're not doing that next year. We'll do that in the following season. But the women were changing their hair color in New York.
It was insane. And again, I'm not even from New York City. I'm from Buffalo, New York. We're on the complete opposite end, and yet the Son of Sam was scaring the living daylights out of everybody. People were... And again, my mother wasn't even, like, the proper age for it. She was just a small child, really. But everyone, it was like, oh my god. So, I should...
And we'll actually see if we can get statements from your family about Dahmer, too, because that happened in Wisconsin.
I can talk to... because I have...
That was Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Well, West Allis, but...
It's a suburb of Milwaukee. Yeah.
Also happened in Ohio, too.
First kill. I can also see if I can reach out to my uncle, who... would have might have had a little bit more. Because I don't know when he moved to the Illinois area.
But yeah, so we'll get some statements, maybe some pre-recorded statements. And that way we can actually hear them talk.
Yeah.
We'll record some of that. Like I said, some of the stuff, my parents were too young. But...
Let me see, because my mom might have been kind of young for some of this stuff.
Dahmer was 70s. 78 was his first victim. And then 87 to 88. So my parents would have known the later ones.
Yeah. I think my mom, because my mom might have known about some of it, but she was also probably not, because she would have been in some of it, like middle school, high school age.
So, but yeah. So again, we have a lot coming. And then one of my favorites, of course, is Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite topics.
And that brings us into our...
We need to go visit Skinwalker Ranch.
That also brings us into, like, our spooky season.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I would...
Keep listening. We have a lot of exciting things coming up.
Yeah. A lot. So, maybe we'll take a trip to Utah.
I mean, I've always wanted to see Canyons National Park.
So, but with that being said, yeah, just thank you, everybody.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whoopsie. I lost it.
So, thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to turn in your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard. Good night, everybody.
Good night.